Now, last time I was summing up the system of absolutism, and the point that I was making is that it was a police state in a sense, that there was a bureaucracy developed and extended. I mentioned the idea of administrative law, which singled out the royal officials, gave them special status. I mentioned that the king was indeed sovereign in many ways, both lawmaker and judge, but I also tried to make clear that there were limitations on kingship in the 17th century. That there was the obvious limitation of regionalism, that there was the obvious limitation of getting and rousing people, that we are at the beginning of an age of pamphlets, but not yet of an age of arousing the masses, and that, and perhaps I should add, because of the regionalism, patriotism was very slow in growing up. We find patriotism as yet attached to the person of the king. We are as yet in the dynastic age. And the word patriotism, well, in its clear meaning, does not come until the 17th century. Typically enough, the word patriotism is first used in a tract, a pamphlet, praising the French language. Because patriotism is first a language matter, that all people who speak a certain language find a certain identity. Therefore, we should not be surprised that the word patriotism is first used in connection with a tract praising the French language. For language, as it were, a basis for patriotism, is crystallizing. Luther's Bible crystallized the German language. Richelieu founded, remember, the French Academy in 1635, and that French Academy, which still exists today, crystallized the French language. In other words, a patriotism was emerging. Regionalism stood in its way, obviously, in its modern form. But it was emerging through language, through the idea that people came to have a language in common. This is how patriotism eventually emerges. As I said, we must list the divine right of kings as a limitation because they still believed in benevolent attitudes of being, as it were, the father of their people. Thirdly, and to this I came at the end, limitation by traditional privilege and vested interest. Now, this is really a most important limitation. The nobility were there even if they were at court. If they had no local power, they still had their network of clients, their network of people who were dependent upon them. The medieval idea of personal allegiance, the medieval idea of the lord-vassal relationship, still persists. The big noble family had their following. They had their following through the patronage which they could give out. If the king was the center of patronage, he gave that patronage to the big nobles. The big nobles gave it out to those beneath them. So that society must still be viewed as a network of clients and clienteles of one way, of one sort or another. Moreover, the nobility did have special privileges. It paid no taxes in France. It was forbidden to engage in commercial activities. In England, it was forbidden even not to wear certain kind of clothes. In other words, there was an attempt to keep the nobility separate. Even if it was hard-pressed financially or otherwise, there was an attempt to keep it as a class. And from that comes the famous tax exemption of the French nobility and at the same time the fact that they were forbidden to engage in commercial, that is to say, in middle-class activity. So that the nobility still counted. It had lost its local power, but it still had privileges, and the network of relationships still dominated society. Don't look at this society as a society of classes. That is very mistaken. It is not a society of classes. It is a society of clientele relationships. Clientele relationships partly bound to the crown, but mostly bound to the nobility. You've seen that in the French religious wars. The positions people took in the French religious wars were largely due to whether they were clients of, let us say, a great Protestant family like the Coligny or the Montmorency, or a great Catholic family like the Guise. That would determine your position in the French Civil War. It is still a medieval society in many ways of clientele, of a kind of lord-vassal relationship, which is now based not on an oath of allegiance, but which is based on patronage. Thus, therefore, the nobles still hold a residue of power. The king can never be quite sure of them. But beside the nobles stood what are called the ancient institutions. What were these ancient institutions? You know it already, but let me summarize. In France, the highest law court, called the Parliament of France, that was there. And it is that highest law court that will start the rebellion, which you will read about, the rebellion of the Fronde. The highest law court, the Parliament of France. That Parliament became the champion of entrenched privilege and the champion of the nobility, by and large, as against the monarchy. But there is another factor, namely that all institutions tended to become hereditary. That while the monarchy founded a new bureaucracy, that bureaucracy tended to be sucked in to the general patronage and corruption and therefore become hereditary. For example, the whole royal civil service paid a tax to the king, a very famous tax, you'll come across it otherwise later, the so-called Paulette it was called, paid the paulette to the king, and for that paulette, the office could be passed on from father to son. In other words, it was really sold, in a sense, and it could become, again, hereditary. But becoming hereditary, it became another entrenched privilege. So that, next to the ordinary nobility, the ancient nobility, you have a new nobility growing up. Also, in a way, independent of the crown, if it had the money to pay the paulette, independent of the crown, the nobility of the robe, as I told you, they were called robe because so many of them were lawyers and wore lawyers, medieval lawyers' robes. So that we cannot say that the national king was supreme and simply leave it at that, that beside him there were privileged castes. And indeed, the main reason that we must not think of modern ideas in this regard is that society was not a society of classes, but a society of clients. And if you remember that, you will get the whole social picture right through the 18th century. Not classes, but clients. And a network of client relationships is what really mattered. And in that, the king was, in a way, imprisoned, if you like, himself. This is made obvious, fourthly, in a theoretical way as well. For these limitations were enshrined in what people called the fundamental laws. That is to say, the old natural laws about which I talked to you once before. No theorist, even under Louis XIV, held that kings could take property or break contracts. No theory went beyond Bodin in your reading, or beyond his idea of sovereignty. There was still the medieval survival of the idea of fundamental law, springing directly from God, which limited the monarch. Now, all these things distinguish the absolutism of our period from modern absolutism. And yet, in a sense, we are building for the future. For while the reality was as I have described it, theory tended to run ahead of reality. People's viewpoints were changing, even if the reality was not yet changing at an equal rate. That change you can see best in a philosopher, a famous one of the 17th century, in Thomas Hobbes. Some of his ideas you will read in the source book. For Hobbes typifies a change on attitude which as yet in no way corresponds to the change in the reality of the situation. Thomas Hobbes's whole ideas were informed by the same kind of thing which informed the growth of the nation state itself and the kind of limited absolutism I have talked about, religious wars. And the wars out of which he came were the wars of the English Revolution. And what Thomas Hobbes tried to do is to see how such religious conflict could be avoided. In other words, he wanted to do the same thing in the 17th century that Bodin wanted to do in the 16th century. The same thing. But, and this is what you must notice, he is already much further advanced to along the road towards an absolutism where natural law ideas, these theoretical ideas, no longer really count. Thomas Hobbes' ideas then are based on the same problem as Bodin's. How can one get peace amid civil war? Unlike Bodin, there had been lots of civil wars between there. Between Bodin and Hobbes, there had been the French religious wars in many ways, the 30 Years' War, the English Revolution. He wrote on a much heightened background of civil and religious conflict. You mustn't forget that. The question was raised, but unlike Bodin, his sovereign is not limited by any theoretical outside force. There is now a realism which enters, a soberness, a realism. For as Hobbes put it so well, whoever has the power of the sword has the whole sovereignty. That was his basic conclusion from what he had seen, that whoever has the power of the sword has the whole sovereignty. I shall come back to a lot of idiocy which has been written about Hobbes, especially by a man called Macpherson, that he was already somehow connected with something called the marketplace, a term that the century doesn't know exists. No, Thomas Hobbes was not concerned with something like economics and the marketplace at all. He was concerned with whoever has the sword has the sovereignty, not whoever has economic power. Didn't dawn to Hobbes. You will see he wanted to limit economic power, in fact. But whoever has the sword has the sovereignty. Might makes right, quite true. And this might remind you of Machiavelli, with one great difference, which you must bear in mind. Thomas Hobbes no longer had the ethical goal of Machiavelli's Republic. He no longer had that goal of the Republic, of the participation that Machiavelli had. Power for Hobbes is something of itself, above its object, beyond its object. That is very important to remember. And that also is an important development. For this is accompanied, of course, by what you might call a materialistic outlook on the world. No longer an outlook that looks to God or to higher powers or to a general ethical principles, but a materialistic outlook. Hobbes starts from man and not from God. And the man he starts from, the idea of man he starts from, has much in common with Machiavelli, both again writing in disturbed times, in crucial or crisis times. He has a dim view of human nature, the war of one against all. Man is, in other words, for him, as for Machiavelli, a wolf who would go and eat up his fellow man. And if there was not power, coercive power, power, sheer power, the power of the sword, and that's what he meant by power, power of the sword, there would be war of man against man and all against all. In this you see again the shadow of the Civil War in England, of the 30 Years' War, of the religious war. For Hobbes believed that for the sake of peace, men would give up their rights, would give up their privileges, would give up their sovereignty. They really had no choice. It was being eaten or having an impartial power which keeps peace, but which keeps peace through the use of power. Now, all of this is directly connected, and again I must emphasize this for you. It is directly and immediately connected to the political scene. Hobbes assumed that in return for giving up their power, men would enjoy their possessions. He never thought of absolutism, that it would take away people's enjoyment. It would make sure of it, because if you did not have the sovereign, you couldn't enjoy your possessions, because in that case it would be the war of one against all. And it never occurred to him that the absolute ruler, the sovereign of Hobbes, would take away these possessions. Though, of course, unlike Locke, there are no sanctions, and there can be no sanctions against the sovereignty. For Hobbes, as for Locke, individualism was tied to property. Property in the medieval sense, not the modern sense. If you're a 16th century expert, you get nothing more fed up than people writing books about these men who have no idea of the Middle Ages and who therefore don't know their words. In a thinker like Hobbes, everything depends on the way he uses his words like property. And if you read it in from the 20th century to Hobbes and Locke, well, it isn't really worth discussing. So, tied to property in the medieval sense, as Locke uses it, property is not just private property. Property is your rights, all your inherited rights. I would say all the feudal rights which you have in your station. This is individualism, but it is surrounded by the idea of power, by a struggle for power, and a struggle for possessions. But it is the duty of the sovereign to stop this struggle. Let me explain it to you from Hobbes a little differently. Hobbes is still medieval in this, that all relationships in Hobbes between the people and the sovereign, as you will read, and between the people themselves, all relationships are contractual relationships. That is to say, so they were in the Middle Ages. They are contractual relationships. But these contractual relationships are no longer built into divine law, into natural law. They are a matter of convenience. They are put on a pragmatic ground. They're not matters of innate difference between people anymore. They are matters of convenience. And this includes the relationship between social classes. It includes the relationship of the Commonwealth to the sovereign. Now, Hobbes believed that these contractual relationships had to be one-way contracts as far as the sovereign was concerned. Otherwise, you would all eat each other. For Hobbes believed that man's appetites are boundless, and he ties this not to economic ambition, but actually at this point to a very Christian source, the same source that Thomas More tied it to, pride and vanity. And if you know anything about Christian theology, it's always very remarkable how people who talk about these things know nothing about the ideas which surround all this, which is Christian theology. What Hobbes really believes is that why people are animals is that they have the sin of pride, the sin of vanity. Traditionally in Christianity, the greatest sins. And to get rid and to contain these sins, the sovereign must contain man's appetites. Here is a Stoic element in there too. He must contain man's passions. Passions always the enemy. Man's passions, and therefore he must contain man's appetites. And that for Hobbes includes man's material appetites, as well as all his other appetites, which may lead to a war among all men. It cannot be proven from Hobbes for a minute that he approved the pursuit of wealth. It is true that in the Leviathan he makes some factual statements. There are some people who pursue wealth. I mean, big, hairy deal. There were obviously some people who were pursuing wealth. But to build a whole theory about Hobbes on that seems to me rather infantile. It is a factual statement in the Leviathan, totally factual statement in the context. But Hobbes goes on straight away that the sovereign must stop this. He must, in fact, protect the poor. This is one thing the sovereign has to do. He has to protect the poor. It is the sovereign, and the sovereign only, who determines the difference between how much people can acquire, and not just wealth, because Hobbes is never solely or even mainly concerned with wealth. How much people can acquire, how much their evil natures, in other words, in his terms, can come forward, and how much restraint is necessary. That goes, of course, also for economic activity. Now, what is new in Hobbes is that he no longer believes in moral restraints alone, like the humanists. But instead, he puts this absolutism on a pragmatic base. But that pragmatic base is not new. It is a view of man as prone to acquisitiveness in all directions, including economic acquisitiveness, which you already have in Thomas More's Utopia a century earlier, and which, in a sense, for all its pragmatism, has very definite ties with medieval as well as modern consideration. Thomas Hobbes, then, whatever in your reading, whatever you say about him, first of all, is concerned with power as power. That is to say, he does not link it to anything solely. He doesn't say it's just economic power or just political power. If he links it to anything, it's the power of the sword. And there's no great astonishment. That's also a big, hairy deal. After all, he lived in a time when the power of the sword was indeed deciding which way England was going to go, had already decided, in a sense, from that point of view, which way Central Europe was going to go. So that's nothing. But power as power is what counts in Hobbes. And on that basis, secondly, there is a theory of human nature. It is the second thing that counts. Pragmatic, the same as Machiavelli's, but going from the same historical context. Thirdly, from this you have the idea of sovereignty and the sovereign. Now, Hobbes is unclear. The sovereign can be a parliament. The sovereign can be a king. He probably thought of it as a king. He was a tutor to the sons of King Charles II of England. He probably thought of it as a king. It doesn't have to be. And this sovereign, as it were, then, is necessary in order to keep the peace. Lastly, relationships are contractual relationships. He's still thinking in terms of a contract theory of government. They are contractual relationships, but the basis of them is no longer really divine and natural law. It comes into it tangentially. But the basis for these relationships is convenience. And that gives it a new kind of secular, pragmatic slant. But that pragmatic slant does not take in any more emphasis on economics than you have in many thinkers of that last century, and less emphasis on economics than a fellow theorist of his day, not so famous, Harrington. But Harrington actually is the first to make real economic connections between power and economics. It's not Thomas Hobbes, but his contemporary Harrington, who for the first time makes this connection between economics and power. No relation to our president, whatever you may think about economics and power. However that is, it was Harrington then who made the connection and not Hobbes. This is, as I say, a misreading. Now what you have therefore at Hobbes then is a change of attitude. It's not yet reality anywhere. It's not yet reality anywhere. But it'll become reality. It will become an attitude. And yet, from a point of view, from that point of view, John Locke is equally important. For John Locke, whom you will also read, can show us this, that the old medieval idea of rights is not dead. For Locke held much more clearly that government is for protection and not robbery, for protection of rights and privileges. He uses the word property, but it doesn't mean just private property. He means the feudal relationships. I can't emphasize that enough, because more idiocy has come out of not knowing terms and words. Words are important, and they do change in their meaning. So that Locke again means a whole series of rights. But the difference between Locke and Hobbes is equal obvious. For Locke, there is a sanction, the sanction of revolution. Because Locke as yet believes that these rights are part of a higher law, of a divine law, of a higher law. And because they are part of a higher law, you must obey God rather than man. And therefore, if the sovereign violates it, you can revolt. Because a sovereign is, for Locke, for protection and not for oppression. In Hobbes, where there is no longer a higher law, properly, there is no sanction against the sovereign. But in Locke, there is that sanction. So that we can say very briefly, perhaps, that Hobbes starts us on the road to modern absolutism, and Locke starts us on the road to modern liberalism. Both of these are on that road, but both of these have still a lot of medieval elements in them. In Hobbes, the contract and all of this. In Locke, the higher laws for all his pragmatism. We can say then absolutism and liberalism are accompanied then by these factors. But I must add three others to them, very briefly. First of all, the pragmatism of Hobbes goes hand in hand with a growing hostility to Christianity, to which I shall come, with a really growing anti-Christian movement among intellectuals only, of course. Secondly, you have as a dialectic opposite, because I've told you things work dialectically, the impetus of a religious revival, Jansenism in France, Puritanism in England, which will become bound up with the First Great Revolution. The First Great Revolution doesn't come from Hobbes, it comes from a religious revival, from an old religious revival, rather than from this pragmatism of Hobbes. And thirdly, you must see the dialectic of the 17th century, not only in terms of absolutism, but in terms of revolution. Some, like the Fronde in France, wanted to restore the nobility and to restore the medieval thing, medieval way of life. The other, the constant peasant revolts, are a part of a general pattern. And here again I come back to with what I started out. These revolutions are not the kind of revolutions that, let us say, romantically you may like. These were peasant revolts. Neither Luther's nor any others are revolutions as you think about them, because you know what your thought is filled with, the archetypal revolution, the French Revolution. You always think the people rise and the bad middle classes take it away. That happened all the time, you know. So it's a sad story, but it's not the story, you know. As Lenin already realized, you know, you can't have a storming of the Bastille in the age of the machine gun. So, however that might be, these revolutions take place within a setting of society which is not a setting of class, but a setting of contractual client relationships. Therefore, in these peasant wars, these peasant uprisings, the seigneur, the lord, aided the peasants, because very often both of them opposed the king. Both of them opposed the tax collector. Both of them opposed the intrusion of new factors which would end this traditional society, which was not a society of class, but a society of these contractual and client relationships. On the whole, neither the peasant nor the lord wanted to break these client relationships. You get it very wrong if you think the peasant wanted to break it. For the peasant had a choice. If he wanted to break it, he came under the tax collector and the central government, which was symbolized in France by the intendant and his tax collector. And the peasant was better off, no doubt, under the seigneur than he was under the tax collector. So that on the whole, these rebellions, these peasant rebellions had these faces to it. They were rebellions against the king's exactions, encouraged by the lord and the seigneur. At times they were rebellions of town against country. Again, rebellions in which the seigneur, the lord, very often joined. And indeed the local officials very often joined. And at times these rebellions were one region against another. And again, in these peasant rebellions, the lords and many of the officials joined. I told you once before that in the great German peasant revolt, as far as we know about it, and we don't know everything about it yet, as far as we know about it, in the regions in which the German peasants revolted, they were often joined by the lord's officials, the constable, and everybody else joined. And in fact, the peasants' demand, by and large, was to keep things in the feudal order and not to destroy it. In other words, you will misunderstand all these revolts in the century and in the previous one, and the whole tenure of popular movements in that age, if you think of them as modern rather than as medieval. What the peasant looked back to, whether in France or in Germany, was his old village community. And his old village community included the lord, included the lord's servants, included a feudal kind of relationship. These revolts are not modern revolts. Modern revolts don't come till the French Revolution. And you must be very careful, now that we head into our first great revolution in this course, not to think about revolutions in the French Revolution manner. That is as yet ahead. The Bastille had not yet been stormed, or as you would say, occupied. That is an archetypal revolution. Well, this is where it comes from. That's where it comes from historically. That's where it comes from. This is the archetypal kind of revolution. The French Revolution, as you will see, will be the archetypal one, except for Leninism, which realizes quite rightly that in the age of machine guns, you don't storm any more Bastilles. And that is what much of Leninism will be built on, as you will see next term, the Leninist thought. But it's very odd how this archetypal revolution has influenced all our thinking about revolution. though it has not been successful, and Leninism has. That's the historical irony about it. But Leninism takes patience, I suppose. What you have here, therefore, is revolution before the French Revolution. Therefore, a revolution as yet within a society that is structured quite differently than the society before, and certainly the society after industrialization, after the French Revolution, after European industrialization. Now, thirdly, then, the dialectic makes not only absolutism and revolution. These revolutions are peasant revolts in Europe, peasant revolts which have their own nature and their own dynamic, which you must not confuse with modern revolts. It's town against country, region against region, against the king's exaction, but not for any class reason that you might read into it. That was not yet invented. The millenarianism of the peasants operated in such a framework, for these revolutions were a part of the kind of apocalyptic and millenarian ideas which we have talked about so much at the beginning of the course. Now, these revolutions never became consistent revolutions against absolutism, because they were of one region against another, of country against town, so largely regional, like all peasant uprisings, like the German peasant war. They never became a consistent threat to absolutism. They never became a consistent threat to the monarchy. No more than you can say in retrospect, the peasant war in Germany really consisted in the last resort in what you would call a serious and consistent threat to absolutism. That serious and consistent threat was not to be had on the continent in Europe. It occurred not in Europe, but in England. For it was England which was to have the first modern revolution. Modern in the sense that it was a revolution nationwide, consistent, inasmuch as there was a movement which carried on and carried through to success, and which has and shows us already many features of modern revolutions. The initial success and the compromise at the end. For every modern revolution has ended in coalition politics and in compromise. Whether you will have the English Revolution or the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution is still more interesting because in the end Bolshevism becomes much more than just coalition politics. It fuses dialectically with its enemy, fascism. But still, you have at the end always a kind of compromise. As we come to this revolution, there's one other thing that we must be clear about. Revolutions don't spring up just because some people want them. There is no such thing, and there has never been such a thing, as a spontaneous revolution. There have been many people who have longed for a spontaneous revolution, but it has historically remained in the realm of wishful thinking or wish fulfillment at times, but there has never been such a thing. Two things are necessary for a successful revolution. That is clear. One is the historical or objective condition. And the second thing is a movement with an elite leadership, with a leadership by an elite. You don't make revolutions by storming Bastilles. You make it by preparing a movement with an elite leadership. The reason, therefore, that I have left England out of this course up to this point, even 16th century England, is that as we come to the first great modern revolution, we must first consider the English past, that is, the past of England. For a century or more before that revolution, for revolutions are a long time in the making, especially successful ones, are a long time in the making, and the movement and the elites are equally a long time, long, long time in the making. And therefore, we must go back next time to 16th century England to lay the groundwork for the revolution.